Morning.
Good
morning. Morning, everybody. I'm going to talk this morning about an essay in this book, Heart of Zen. It's a little booklet that was put out by the Soto Shu that I got recently. And it's a book that has a couple of different essays in it. And one of them is called Points to Watch in Practicing the Way. And this was actually one of the first Soto Zen texts that was printed in Japan. So it's an older text from our point of view. It was written by Dogen, Eihei Dogen, who's the founder of Soto Zen in Japan. And this is something that he wrote. It's a series of essays that he wrote after he came back from China and after he founded his first monastery. About a year later, he wrote this series of essays that were meant to encourage the monks in the monastery. But the thing I like about it is that it holds up really well, you know, 800 years later in a definitely non-monastic setting. So, it's a guide for practice, it's a good intro, and I want to say something about three of the essays in it, just real quickly, and then concentrate on the sixth one. So the first essay in it is called The Necessity of Arousing Bodhi Mind. Excuse me. And Dogen defines Bodhi Mind as the mind that solely sees the impermanence of this world of constant appearance and disappearance. The mind that sees the impermanence of the world. So Bodhi mind just means the mind of awakening. It's the mind that notices that there's something sort of beyond this humdrum everyday here and now. And I think that's a good place to start because that's where all of our spiritual practices begin, you know, when you first notice that. It's the first couple of steps on the Eightfold Path, you know, right view, right intent, where you're just even becoming aware that there's something else that you should be, or that you could be thinking about other than, you know, when you're going to get your next latte. So he starts out with the necessity of arousing Bodhi mind. Not that I'm against your next latte. I am pro-latte. Excuse me. And his third essay is called You Should Enter the Buddha Way Through Practice. Dogen says, the Buddha said realization lies in practice. And then I meaning Dogen. So Dogen says, I have never heard of anyone who attained realization without practice. One of the things that I liked very early on about Buddhism was this notion of don't take my word for this. Don't take my word for this. You have to do this for yourself. You have to test out what we're saying here. That seemed like a very self-confident thing to say to me. I mean, don't take this on faith. You absolutely need to do it on your own. And Dogen said you should enter the Buddha way through practice, and I think I would change that to you must. I mean, there's no other way to do this than through practice. You're not going to get it from book learning. You're not going to get it from, you know, dinking around. You've got to actually do the practice. His fourth essay is called Do Not Practice Buddha Dharma with Gaining Mind. And here he said, a practitioner of the Buddha Dharma should not practice for his own sake. How can you possibly think of practicing for fame and profit? Just practice for the sake of the Buddha Dharma. I think this is, when people are starting out, this is a really hard concept to get. I was interviewed last week, and one of the only question that really stumped me was they asked, why do you meditate? And I went completely blank. I mean, I know sort of classical answers to this. You know, it calms the mind, and we do this without gaining mind. But I couldn't come up with an answer that that she would understand. You know, and afterwards, and so I thought about it all week. And afterwards, I thought, you know, it's really kind of a capitalist kind of question. You know, it's like, I'll do this and then I'll get that. I'll do this and then I'm going to get something for it. And I think that you just can't do this practice with that kind of attitude. You have to do it leaving your mind open to whatever comes up. I saw a quote this week from Einstein that said, "The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious." And I like that idea of just doing zazen with this mind of, it's mysterious, maybe I don't get it, but I'm just going to do this. Just do it. Just do it. So, then the essay of his that I want to concentrate on here in here is number 6. And it's called Things Which Should Be Kept in Mind in Practicing Zen. And as I read it, there were 6 points in it that I thought he made that were really good. It's only like 3 pages long, but it had a lot in it. So I want to spend most of my time talking about these 6 points. And the first one is expect this practice to be rigorous. Expect it to be rigorous. He says, practicing Zen and learning the way is the most important matter of your whole life. Never take it lightly, nor be imprudent in practice. So I have to start with an apology. It's not easy. It's not an easy practice. I'm sorry. But I think any spiritual practice isn't easy. It's just not easy. You know? And when I first came to Zen, I was actually looking for a rigorous practice because I had been a member of a couple of other churches, and at some point at each one I went, well, but now what? Now what? What do I do with this? Now what? And so I liked the rigor. I liked the rigor of Zen. On the other hand, you know, you don't have to live in a monastery to do this. I firmly believe that. You know, people say sometimes that, you know, you can't do this unless you go to a monastery and do nothing but, you know, sit and spend 8 years doing, you know, 9 years facing the wall like Bodhidharma did. And I think that you can do this while you're living a regular life, you know, with family and job and vacations and a dog, you know. But I think that whatever your spiritual practice is should inform the entire rest of your life. You know, the Eightfold Path is Buddha's prescription for ending suffering, and it's right there. And if you throw yourself into that Eightfold Path and that practice, it's going to affect everything. And I think that's true of any spiritual practice. I talk about my Catholic aunties. I have 6 Catholic aunties, and I always neglect the 5 Catholic uncles and all their husbands and wives. But these aunts of mine are extraordinarily devout women. And they don't talk about it, but when you're with them, that just shines out of them. It just shines out of them, and you can see it in every aspect of their lives, and so they're my role models. But that doesn't come from, they didn't get there by just going to church on Sunday. You know, they've had a very rigorous spiritual life. You know, maybe you don't like the word rigor. Maybe devout. Cindy likes the word rigor. All right. But, you know, it'll change our lives. It's worth doing. But it takes discipline. So, another thing he said in this section was, Even an ancient of great ability said the Buddha way is difficult to practice. Compared to the ancients, people today are less than one hair to that of the hairs of nine cows. Compared to the ancients, people today, he's talking about 1200, people today are less than one hair to that of the hairs of nine cows. And it says in the notes that that means an insignificant amount. Therefore, even if we with inferior ability and intelligence aspire to difficult practice, that practice cannot even measure up to the practice and understanding the ancients considered easy. So, how about that? I love it when they go off on a rant. I wish we could get away with that today. It's interesting to me. It's interesting to me. It shows, you know, Dogen's, it shows that his human nature. You know, don't we all do this? Don't we all think, well, we live in a degenerate age where we can't possibly do this because the ancients really knew this stuff. The ancients really had it. But now we with inferior ability and intelligence just couldn't possibly. And I think this is a really natural human tendency. I mean, I do this with both of my teachers. I study the way of sewing with Tomoe Katagiri, and I know for a fact that I will never be as good a sewing teacher as she is. I just know it, and I can tell you that without any false humility. And she tells me that she is not anywhere near as good a teacher as her revered teacher. You know? And I just know that I will never have the breadth of knowledge or the depth of understanding that Tim will. And he tells me the same thing about his teacher, Suzuki. Well, what does that tell you? You know, shouldn't this have disappeared a long time ago if it narrows down like that? So I think it's a real human tendency to say that. But the other point about the ancients is... I don't mean Tim as an ancient. Is that I think we need to respect the practice that's been handed down all those years and receive it with gratitude and show our gratitude by our diligent efforts. You know? I think it's important. He goes on in this vein. This is my favorite vein, actually. People today say that we should practice what is easy to practice. Guess what? The next line, this is completely wrong. What on earth are these teachings of easy practice and easy understanding which people today prefer? They are inferior even to the practice of celestial demons, non-Buddhists, Shravakas or Pratyeka Buddhas. They are nothing other than the phantoms of deluded beings. Deluded beings. My favorite example of this from right now, and I've talked about this before, was about 10 years ago. I was at work and I was listening to the radio and I heard an ad for Dayton's Warehouse sale. And it said, and I quote, "Have you ever experienced Zen? That feeling that everything is downright groovy in your little world." And I got on email and I emailed my teacher and said, when do we get to the downright groovy part? So that's Buddhism light, and we see a lot of it. And apparently, Dogen was worried about it 1,200 years ago, too. You know, don't take the easy path. So that's his first point in things which should be kept in mind in practicing Zen. And his second one is enter by harmonizing the body and mind, not by intelligence. And he says, neither intelligence nor broad knowledge is of primary importance. Intellect, volition, consciousness, memory, imagination, and contemplation are of no value. Without resorting to these methods, enter the Buddha way by harmonizing body and mind. So in the Fukan Zazengi, in his Universal Recommendations for Zazen, Dogen says, put aside the intellectual practice of investigating words and chasing sayings, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. And this is a backward step. You know, when you think about the idea of a backward step, imagining being out there on the front porch as you're leaving, and leaving by walking backwards down those steps. You know, it's going to be a little bit disconcerting, and it's going to be a little bit awkward. But what you're going to be doing if you do that is you're going to be thinking very, or you're going to be paying attention, not thinking, you're going to be paying attention really closely to what you're doing. And you're going to be paying attention to how your body is moving. And you're going to do it very sort of intentionally and carefully. And very carefully. But what you're not going to be doing is thinking about it too much. You know, when you can't see where you're going, sometimes you have to kind of let go of that thinking. I think this is a hard one. This is a hard one for those of us who have always relied on our smarts. You know, it's a hard one to let go of that. But it's an important one to do. You know, you've got to harmonize your body and mind. I think it's a really interesting paradox. The people that I've met at Zen centers are probably the smartest, most intellectual people in my life. And yet, we have this practice that says, don't rely on that. Don't rely on that. I think it's an interesting paradox to me. I think it's a hard thing to do. We want to concentrate on the study part of it, and we want to concentrate on the knowing part of it. And yet, we have to let go of that. So, the other thing that he says in this one is, if one could enter the Buddha way with intelligence and broad knowledge, Jinshu would be the person who is qualified to be the Dharma successor of the fifth ancestor. Transmission of the Buddha way has nothing to do with intelligence or broad knowledge. I gave a talk on this story last year. Jinshu is the Japanese version of the name for Shen Sui, who was the precept instructor and sort of head student at a large monastery in, was it 7th century? 7th century China. And everybody expected him to be probably the next abbot and the next Dharma heir, until an illiterate kitchen worker named Wei Neng came along and really impressed the abbot with his sort of native, raw understanding. And he kind of blew poor Shen Sui out of the water. He showed that his depth of understanding far exceeded it by responding to a poem that Shen Sui had written. So, and actually I always really felt for poor Shen Sui. But that story points to how this is beyond knowledge. It's beyond what we know. It's beyond, you know, making the lists and being able to come up with all the, you know, the names of, well, this one did this and this one did that and all that stuff. It's beyond that. It's a different kind of understanding. And that's what Dogen's talking about there. His next point, his third point in here, is that you can be old or young. He says, also, the Buddha way is closed neither to the aged nor to the young. And I was this one is a big relief for me, because I started doing this when I was 40 years old. And I've often thought, you know, if I had entered a monastery when I was, you know, 12, I might, you know, I might something, 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 you know. But then I look at people like Tonin O'Connor, who's the head teacher at Milwaukee Zen Center, and Blanche Hartman, who was for years the abbot at San Francisco Zen Center. And these are people who started their practice when they were middle-aged. And they are amazing. And they have done, you know, really not only fabulous practice, but they have spread the Dharma in big ways throughout their lives and been really inspirational. And, you know, they were about the age that I was when I started. So, you know, I think about them and it reminds me that it's the dedication. It's the dedication that matters. And I also worry that, you know, because I started when I was 40, my memory isn't what it was when I was 19. I can't, you know, Buddhism is just so full of lists and I can't memorize lists anymore. But that takes me back to number two, enter by harmonizing the mind. Enter by harmonizing the mind. Don't worry so much about the thinky part about this. So, and on the flip side, Dogen also says that you can be very adept at this at a really young age. You know, and the sutras and the koans are just full of stories of people who were very young who taught the Zen masters something. One of them, who I have totally forgotten the name of, or where this even came from, but talked about how he would learn the Dharma from anyone, you know, even an 8-year-old girl. And, you know, being young like that and being a girl was sort of the lowest of the low. He would learn it even from an 8-year-old girl. So you can be either old or young studying the way. And his fourth point is to find a good teacher. And when I teach Intro to Zazen, one of the things that I tell people is to do this practice, you know, you don't need a cushion, you don't need bells, you don't need candles, you don't need incense. The two things that you really do need are a good teacher and a sangha or a community of practitioners. And Dogen doesn't talk here about sangha, but I think that's also crucial. Of course, he was talking to monks in a monastery, so they already had one. So maybe it was obvious. But the reason that you need a good teacher for this is that when you're doing a lot of meditation, things come up. And it's, you know, you're studying your mind. And it's really easy to be disconcerted by that or to kind of get knocked off your cushion. It's really easy to kind of lean one way or lean another. And you need that support. You need that support. Sometimes you need some correction. You know, you kind of go off into, I could never do this in a million years, you know, and you get some support. You know, or you can go off into grandiosity. I alone, you know, have learned the Buddha way. Nobody ever talks about that. Sometime I'm going to give a talk on grandiosity so that everybody who's ever gone off into that can feel better. So we always talk about how, oh, our lack of understanding. But so, a teacher and a sangha are really important. And later on in this section, he also talks about visiting other Zen masters, which I think is really good advice. I think you need to look around, find a good teacher that works for you in particular, and really settle down. Settle down in one place. Settle down with one sangha and one teacher. And settle in really thoroughly. And then sometimes kind of get out. You know, I have a resolution that I really stick to. Of every year, I do a retreat somewhere else that I haven't ever been before. And I think it's just really a good idea. It makes you not be so insular, and I learn things about the way other people do the same practice, and sometimes I come back and I'm just so grateful for this place. Oh, look at what we have here. Look at what we have here. So it widens the perspective, but it also can make you grateful. Another thing he says under that one is, clarifying the Dharma and attaining the way comes with the power gained from practice under an enlightened teacher. Just listen to his or her words without twisting them to fit your own views. And I think a lot of you probably know the story about the person who goes to visit the Zen master and wants to learn from the Zen master, and so the Zen master is pouring tea for him while this person chatters on, and the master pours the tea into the teacup, and he keeps pouring and pouring, and the teacup starts overflowing, and this person interrupts their conversation to say, you know, look at what you've done, the cup is overflowing, and the master says, like this cup, you are full of your own opinions and speculations. How can I show you Zen unless you first empty your cup? And I like the image. For today, I use this image of a cup with a piece of cellophane over it. You know, a piece of saran wrap over it. If you try to pour tea into that cup, nothing's going to happen. So not only do you have to have a teacher, but you have to be able to listen. And I think this isn't only true with a teacher, but I think it's also true with your sangha and the people that you encounter. excuse me, I had a conversation a couple weeks ago with someone. This wasn't here, and it was in a totally different context. But we had this conversation where there were a couple of us, and one person really knew a lot about something, and the other person said, oh yeah, I read a book about that once, and blah 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 blah, and this was sort of their only opportunity maybe to get to know about it from somebody who really knew. But what they did was kind of talked about this teeny little piece that they knew, and it got me thinking, how often do I do that? So I just watched myself for about 3 weeks to see how often I did that just with other people, you know. Talked when I should have been listening, and it was embarrassing. It really was. So I think not only with our own teachers, this is something that we can watch. Learning to, once in a while, this is especially for us extroverts, learning to shut up and listen and pay attention and consider what we're hearing and consider that the point of view that we've been holding so dearly might not be the only one. Might not be the only one. So, and that leads very nicely into his next point, which is to keep your views and your ego in check. He says, there's a group of people who put primary importance on their own views, read scriptures, memorize a few phrases, and grasp them as the Buddha Dharma. Later, when they practice with a master, if the master's words agree with their own views, they consider them true. If the master's words do not match their preconceptions, they consider them false. They will remain deluded for countless kalpas. This is most pitiful. Do you know how long a kalpa is? It's a really long time. So, there are a couple of points here. One is that you cannot learn this from a book. I know I tried. You can't learn it from a book. You know, the more I read, the more intrigued I got, and the more confused I got. So I kept reading more books, and I kept thinking, somewhere out there is the book that's going to explain this stuff to me. And, you know, if you found it, please tell me what it is so I can stop sitting every day. But I don't think it's out there. I don't think it's out there. In order to understand Zen, you need to sit. You need to have a steady sitting practice, and you need to work with a teacher. And that's the way to understand it. That's the only way that I know of to understand it. So, and then the other point here, of course, is to listen to others. You know, even when what you're hearing doesn't match your preconceptions, it's astonishing how many preconceptions we have and how dearly, dearly we hold on to them. You would think they were our children or something. We just, you know, hold on to them so closely, to our ideas about the way that things are. And, you know, sometimes it's just ego striving. That's all it is. So it's important to be open to what your teacher says. On the other hand, I'm not saying that the teacher is always right. It's really important, as my girlfriend Mary Lehman says about Zen teachers, keep your eyes open. Any kind of teachers. You know, if you get offered Kool-Aid, don't take it. Please don't take it. But while you're keeping your eyes open, also keep your mind open. And don't dismiss things out of hand. And if there's something that doesn't match your preconceptions, you know, maybe you just put it up on that shelf that says awaiting future enlightenment or something, and just let it sit there and let it percolate and see. And who knows, you know? A year from now, it might make sense. Or a year from now, you may say, oh, I don't know about that. But if you dismiss it out of hand, it's just gone and you're out of luck. So, point number 6, it's beyond thinking. The Buddha way lies beyond thinking, discrimination, viewing, contemplation, perception, and intellection. In practicing the way, you should not use thinking or discrimination. In Fukan Zazengi, in the Universal Recommendations for Zazen, it says, think of what does not think. How do you think of what does not think? Non-thinking. I think this is maybe one of the most aggravating sentences that that Dogen ever wrote. But recently I heard a talk that really opened it up for me, in which the Japanese words were translated literally. So this helped me. Think. The Japanese word for that is shirio, and it means, literally, it means think, measure. So when you put measure on that, it's the kind of thinking that's evaluating. That's our usual kind of thinking mind. While we're thinking, we're also evaluating. And then what does not think is fushirio, and that's just not thinking. So you're using your thinking evaluating mind to think of what does not think. And then non-thinking is hishirio. And that is not a matter of thinking or not thinking. So it's both beyond thinking and it includes thinking. So I hope that cleared it up. But if you think about standing outside under the sky, and maybe there are clouds that come and go, and maybe if you stand there all day, the weather changes completely. And when you're sitting, you know, maybe thoughts come and go, and maybe they don't, or maybe you're sad and having this kind of a, you know, this kind of a morning or that kind of a morning. You know, and these clouds are coming and going, and our practice isn't to evaluate those clouds. Or when the rain starts falling down, necessarily to get out of the rain, it's to learn how to stay upright no matter what the weather is. So that's how watching those thoughts and letting them go in Zazen, if you can do that, then maybe you can learn how to do that in the rest of your life. And when the winds start blowing, you know, maybe you can apply that and stay upright just the way you did in Zazen. Even if you're having a morning where your thoughts are all of grief, and you learn that I'm just having a morning of Zazen where I'm just grieving. And I'm whenever I realize that I'm doing this, I let it go and I come back. But deep inside this morning, it's a grieving Zazen, because that's what my body is doing this morning. But you learn that it's just a grieving Zazen morning. You know, it's just those clouds coming and going. And maybe tomorrow morning, I'll have an ecstatic Zazen morning. But it's just an ecstatic Zazen morning. And those clouds come and go too. And you learn that you can sit for that half an hour, or that 40 minutes, or whatever it is. You can sit with whatever comes up, and your life is like that too. And that's taking your Zazen practice off the cushion. So those are the the six things which should be kept in mind in practicing Zen that Dogen talked about in that essay. And the last essay in this section is called Settling Down Right Here. And it's just, it's this very kind of sweet, reassuring, lovely note to end on. I don't usually use those words with Dogen, but I think, but this one is. He says, "Do not try to change your body or mind. Just follow the realization of the true teacher. This is called being here or settling down. Since you just settle down right here, you do not seek a new nest." Let me read that again. "Do not try to change your body or mind. Just follow the realization of the true teacher. This is called being here or settling down. Since you just settle down right here, you do not seek a new nest." And I don't really have much to add to that. We can settle down right here. We don't need to, you know, look around for something else. We don't need to get out of the rain when it's raining, you know. We can settle down right here. So that's what Dogen had to say about that, and that's what I have to say about what Dogen said about that. Anybody else want to say something? Want to say anything about that? Shahaku did. Shahaku Okamura did. This was... Doesn't that sound the same? Yeah, yeah. He went. We actually used this. I was at Milwaukee Zen Center last month, or earlier this month, or something, and we used this. And as we were going through it, he told us that he did the original translation with some American students when he was in Japan, and then when they ran out of this edition, they came back to him, and he made a few changes to the text to make it better English. And then as we weren't doing that part of it, but we were doing a different part. And as we did it, he was going through and making more changes kind of on the fly. So I think, is it? Well, Arnie, where were you last week when I was writing this? I like having lots of different translations. I like having two or three in front of me when I'm studying something. Anybody else?
It was interesting when you were saying that we never feel like we're as good as our teacher. That I had a conversation with Dokai. Once he said to me, "We always have to strive to be better than our teacher." So I was like holding those two things together.
Yeah.
An interesting paradox, I guess.
It is. It is. And when you've been ordained, and then when you're coming up on Dharma transmission or permission to teach independently, the idea is that you have seen eye to eye with your teacher, and that you have, you know, sort of become equal to them in understanding. And I think about that, and I go, well, I don't know, but I suppose that's better than going off into grandiosity. And you want to have a teacher who's, you know, something to strive for, I would think.
I have a question, Rosemary.
Yeah.
Dogen doesn't address it, and it's possible it's because he's speaking to a community of resident monks. We are very blessed here in the Twin Cities. We have what I would call a plethora of really excellent teachers.
We do.
And he doesn't say anything about it, but do you have anything to say about living in an area, people living in an area where there aren't any teachers close enough?
Yeah.
Like, how is that a time when books by a particular teacher are possible, or do you make some sort of pilgrimage once a year, or
I think it's hard, and I feel for those people, and I know there are a lot of people who live in those kind of, you know, more isolated areas. And I think, yeah, I think that there are some books that can be very helpful and guide you. And I think there are also tapes of talks by teachers. There are a lot of those available now. And if you find some teacher that you really like that you can listen to those tapes from, that can be very, very helpful. And I think if I lived in an area like that, I would try... I would try to find some like-minded people so I at least had a Sangha, other people I could talk to about this stuff with. And then I would, as often as I could, I would travel somewhere to have a relationship with the teacher and also to do retreats with the teacher. You know, maybe that would just be once a year, you know, or maybe it would be once a month. But boy, that's what I would do. You know, the books will help and the tapes will help, but boy, yeah. And with somebody who knows you, you know, somebody who knows you, who you can, you know, who can help you sort of straighten back up when you're sagging a little bit, who knows your situation. So, yeah, Guy.
I was going to mention there's increasingly a lot of cyber opportunities.
Good point.
I've been working with somebody in Los Angeles, and he insists you spend a week retreat with him every year. But he also, once a month or so, you know, will have a dokusan, if you will, with you, you know, over the phone or video conference or whatever, and it's great.
So you do that, right? You have a like conference calls or something, right?
Yeah, also conference calls within groups. Yeah. So I'm just saying that there's a lot of opportunities, and they're just beginning to develop. And so if you're really, particularly with somebody like Bonnie, who's pretty advanced, it would be, you know, it would be a great opportunity to connect. I just think that's something that I'm looking at.
I think that's a really good idea. That's a really good idea. I've seen a lot of, also on the web, I've seen bulletin boards and is that what they don't call them bulletin boards anymore, do they?
Forum,
thank you. Yeah, and blogs and things. And I would be real careful about those. I've seen some real junk in them. But I think that it's possible that there are good ones out there. So there's that, too. So. Anybody else? All right. Thank you very much.